Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hey, how's it going?
Hey.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, it's going pretty well. But, you know, I got this problem. You know, I got the Pebble. I love it. We talked about it. But it doesn't have any apps that really track my workout besides Runkeeper. And I'm not really a runner.
So have you tried a Fitbit? That's pretty useful. I love my Fitbit.
Dude, I have a Fitbit. I have a Fitbit One. I love it. If only Fitbit had an app for the Pebble, you know?
Well, it seems like what you're really looking for is one all-in-one device that solves all of those tech and athletic needs like that.
Well, is there anything currently out that does that?
As a matter of fact, I'm so glad you asked. Samsung's got it, and we're going to introduce you to the latest in wearable tech during this episode of The Drill Down. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakan.
This week, Edward Snowden strikes again, this time with the U.S. spy Black Budget, a new Kindle, Samsung's watch, Microsoft buys Nokia, Tosin's PAX Prime experience, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com, subscribe to us on iTunes, by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on facebook.com and twitter.com at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And last week, Dwayne, you talked about the gushed effluviously about the joys of owning a Pebble, you know, this much, like a year into owning it now at this point.
No, it's only been like 9 weeks into actually taking delivery of my orange Pebble, but I love it.
And one of my complaints about that was that I loved it, but I, because I'm such a, you know, klutz, that I have found that I've scratched the face of the Pebble to the extent that it's no longer pristine, and I lamented over there not being a screen protector for it. And really, what I should have done was just look it up on Google, because of course there's a screen protector for it. If they can sell it to you, it exists. And so I got a screen protector for it. This one from a company called Skinomi, who does screen protectors for all sorts of different devices. And I applied it, which took a little bit of work, because you have to like spritz the screen and your fingers with water and then take the screen protector off the adhesive and take it off the backing and lay it on there while it's wet. And then it dries and then seals. But having done that, it's a perfect seal, and in fact, the adhesive in the backing on the screen protector has actually sealed in the scuffs on the screen, so it looks once again pristine, like there's no scuff at all. So that's my solution for that, and it works great. I'm very happy with it.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, the one thing that I'm still missing from my Pebble is just more of an early notification when you're running out of power, because I often find that I just don't always plug it in on a regular basis, and 7 days later, I'm staring at a blank screen.
I don't get a notification that buzzes me, but what I do get is I will see the battery icon on the Pebble. Yeah. It always shows, like, imagine your an iPhone or an Android when the battery is at like 20%. I see that show up whenever I'm doing, and I admittedly, I spend a lot of time hanging out in the menus because I'm always doing something with an app or whatever. So like every like 5-6 days or so, I'll see that little battery icon when I'm in the menu, and then I'll just plug it in that night. That's just kind of how I roll with it. I'm getting 5 to 6 days on the charge, But what are we getting on Samsung's Galaxy Gear situation, Andy?
Battery life on this Galaxy Gear, which is Samsung's latest foray into the smartwatch category. People are complaining that the battery life is about a day. And that is despite the fact that it uses the Bluetooth 4.0 low energy standard. But apparently it's because of, the Pebble has a low energy LED display, and not LED, but it's like a low energy
display. It's like a hybrid between e-paper and LED.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you're saying is totally right. It's just not like when you say e-paper, you think Kindle, and right, the Pebble right, is right, not right, that. Right. It is a different story from that.
But the Galaxy Gear, which leads us right into our first headline here, it's got a 1.9 megapixel camera, a speaker, two microphones. It allows you to shoot 720p movies and even conduct phone calls, which really, you know, Galaxy Gear is not a smartphone in its own right because it relies on a Bluetooth connection to this, to your existing Samsung Galaxy device in order to do the work.
But it is a smart watch. And
sure.
I've heard a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, Pebble and like something, they're not smart watches. This is the Samsung thing. They're not smart watches because they don't have their own connectivity. They have to rely on a phone. But a smartphone is a phone that has its own connectivity. What makes it smart isn't the 3G connection. What makes it smart is the computational ability that it has. A smart watch isn't about the fact that it has Bluetooth that connects to a phone and relies on that phone's data connection in order to give it what it needs. A smart watch is a watch that has the computational component that allows you to get more out of the watch. Watches don't do anything today but tell you the time and the date and maybe like the where the stars are if you've got a really fancy one or something like that, maybe altimeter, that kind of thing. A smart watch is updating you, is buzzing you when you get a phone call. It's smart. It's got that computational ability, which is why I think that this, the Pebble, whatever Apple's going to pull off, whatever Google's going to pull off eventually maybe, all that stuff is smart for the watch standard. So I'm really excited about seeing what Samsung's got going because as a watch person, as a smartwatch person, I have no time for watches when all they do is tell me the time and date because my phone can do that. But when they can do things like make it so I never miss a call because my wrist is going to buzz,
yeah,
that's exciting. When they can do things like I'm driving my car and I get a text message and it's on my wrist. My wrist is in the steering wheel, my hand's on the steering wheel. I don't have to look away from anything to read the text message. That's absolutely fantastic. So these capabilities are part and parcel with the miniaturization of everything, obviously. And on top of that, the fact that watches are pretty stupid right now. They're these status symbols that don't do anything for you. They're about as useless as like, I don't know, engagement rings. Like, oh, it's a rock. It's great. It's going to be around for a long time.
Well, you know what's interesting about this is that even though it is not a standalone device, even though it relies on a phone, because you can use it to communicate on phone calls, it essentially fulfills the ideal of the quintessential Dick Tracy watch that people have been predicting for, well, since Dick Tracy.
Yeah, I think as a prototype, the Samsung Galaxy Watch is pretty cool, but I think it still has a long way to go. I mean, one day is really harsh in terms of battery life. I've been reading articles where they mention that there's a lag when going through the various menus and
I think you're on to something, Tosin. When the original smartphones came out, with the exception of Palm, they were running things like Windows. Windows modified for the phone. Apple came out with a full version of OS X that was focused on mobile usage, and it had crazy battery life and crazy usage. Pebble has come out with a phone-based native OS. A watch-based native OS. And that's what's so tight. So using Android, which is a phone-based native OS, which is constantly more and more power hungry as it gets older and needs a bigger and bigger screen and it's a bigger and bigger battery, there's a problem there. And I think you've identified it, Tosin. This day of battery life is not something that people think about when they're thinking about their mobile or wearable devices. You talked about the Fitbit earlier. The Fitbit gets days upon days upon days. Like my Fitbit Ultra got a week plus before you had to like think about charging it. My Fitbit One gets at least 6 days, if not seven, before I think about charging it. So yeah, there's an issue here, but at the same time, if you're a watch person, I think the Pebble is your daily driver. You can wear it to work. No one's going to look at you funny. The Samsung watch is attractive, but it seems really focused on this sort of like everything else the Pebble hasn't been able to do yet action, including the heart rate monitor, which is it's utterly awesome that you can have a workout watch that is truly a workout watch.
Sounds like you're sold on it.
Well, it's just like Runkeeper's on the Pebble.
Yeah.
And Fitbit is not on the Pebble. But I can probably hop on that Samsung device and I can get on that Samsung Jammy and run the apps and have my heart rate figured out while I'm running and all the rest of it. And I really can take advantage of that. When I'm on a Fitbit, I have to hit a button and hold it and then tell it that I'm about to go do something active later. Like I'm going to put a timer on and I'm going to stop the timer and I'm going to go into the system on my own, on my phone or wherever, and log the fact that I did that work. I rode my bike, I ran or whatever during that time. That is not the easiest way to do things. Now, I love my Fitbit. I have an Aria scale. I'm all like wired in. But if the watch can be like your heart rate went up right here, that's more precise. It's just more precise. Yeah. And in the age of quantified self, which is what I'm excited about, it's the thing where I can look back when I'm 60 and see how much I screwed up my life by not being active. I want to be able to look at the devices. Look at my life. Be able to export like with Fitbit. I pay $50 to get my data out of it via the API. I'm sure Samsung will have the same thing. Android is really good about that, and Samsung is even better about that. So this is going to be strong in terms of giving me that kind of focus and philosophy.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It starts shipping on September 25th, and it's going to be priced at $299. I don't have a Galaxy phone to pair with it, so unfortunately I don't think it's going to be of any use to me, but I'm going to be excited to see how basically this is going to be the high tide that raises all the boats.
And I have a feeling this phone is going to be able to speak to the iPhone in short order.
There's nothing that says it right now, but
frankly,
and it doesn't.
If the Pebble can do it, Samsung can do it via Android.
But it's not a very good strategy for Samsung.
No, it is a good strategy for Samsung, and here's how I'm going to tell you that why it is.
All right.
If you're Samsung and you have a Halo device, like a tight ass Wi-Fi, Bluetooth connected super smartwatch, and it's attractive and beautiful, and you can hit those iPhone guys and that emotional connection, those Apple people and that emotional connection, knowing that it'll work with the same types of APIs that the Pebble's using, they're going to think twice about going and getting your device.
I hear what you're saying. I agree in theory, but I'll tell you right now, before that sort of bleed over can happen, Google and Apple will both come out with their own.
That's fine. Entries. I use a Pebble with an iPhone. What I'm saying is that if you're Samsung or if you're Google or if you're whomever, in fact, Samsung makes better hardware than Google. In fact, so much so that Google has dropped this Samsung Galaxy S4 with the Google OS on it that works better than this Moto X that they control. What I'm saying is a watch person buys a couple watches and uses them for different things. And if you're Samsung, you're not going to lock people out of using your watch with the iPhone because you're like, hey, look, I've made a good product. I've made a product that's going to make you think twice about my brand. And even if you don't switch over, I can at least make that $100 to $320, whatever, on you. This incremental growth that I wouldn't have made otherwise.
Sure.
I wouldn't have made that money otherwise because you're just buying iPhones. So here's my watch. You can buy it. It works with your phone. God bless.
Yeah. I think the exciting thing for me is how this is going to affect all wearable devices. But, you know, this wasn't the only new device that was announced this week. Amazon rebooted their Kindle, Kindle Paperwhite. And in this new version, the screen is significantly brighter at the maximum setting. It's more evenly lit. Fonts are darker, improved contrast, and the touch responsiveness is also improved by 19%, according to Amazon. What's exciting to me isn't, because this feels to me like an incremental update to the Paperwhite, because I have a Paperwhite, and I'm not compelled to buy this new one for the incremental updates. But what is interesting to me is the new service that Amazon announced with it, which is called Kindle Matchbook. And essentially how that works is if you purchased a physical paper book from Amazon anytime in the time that you have been an Amazon customer, they're going to make these the Kindle version available to you at either either free or at a discounted free to $2.99 to $2.99, which is significantly less than the $9.99 price of most ebooks sold through Amazon. So this is essentially what Amazon did with their Music Locker service, where they were offering you the digital, the MP3 versions of any CD that you physically purchased over the course of your being an Amazon customer. But now they're doing it with books, which I think is a brilliant idea.
Yeah, this is brilliant. This is totally brilliant. Like, I should buy the media once, right, and have access to it regardless. Amazon's doing a good job of this. Apple's done a reasonable job of this. I've bought 720p Apple movies and have it, you know, and Apple upgraded them to 1080p movies when the third generation of the Apple TV showed up. Which is also really damn good. We'll see what happens when 4K and 8K stuff shows up. But this is the thing. Like, I remember I'm ready to binge it. He would buy the DVD version of Neon Genesis Evangelion and then buy the Blu-ray version when it came out. And you'd be like, wait, you own that already? And he'd be like, dude, slash film. and that's like what was up. And I was always upset about the fact that I get it. These companies want to make incremental or like straight up revenue. They want to update their stuff. Peter Jackson wants to release the super ridiculous extended, super awesome version of Lord of the Rings. And George Lucas wants to update his Star Wars all the time. But the fact is, you want to be able to download or buy a product and know that it's going to stand the test of time, especially when it's a digital product. A hardware product, a watch, a phone, yeah, you're going to have to upgrade that eventually. But what ends up happening is that, you know, you need to not feel as if you're getting taken for a ride every single time.
Right.
And that's what's so tight about this.
Double dipping, as they call
exactly.
it. Tosin, any thoughts on the Kindle, on the new Paperwhite or the Kindle Matchbook service?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's another progression for Amazon. I think they already pretty much dominate that market, so, or at least so it feels. They dominate that market. People are happy with what they have. Yeah, I mean, it's more like, oh, same old, to be expected.
Right.
What's next?
All right, let's continue our coverage of NSA Spywatch. And just a couple of brief things. You know, there's some information, new information came out that was leaked by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden. And I'm less interested in the information itself than the audacity that that he actually accomplished by leaking this stuff out. The Washington Post reported that Edward Snowden released the U.S. spy agency black budget, the $52.6 billion black budget for fiscal 2013, which is like one of the most, it's basically the top secret itemized budget that U.S. spy agencies use to determine what they're going to spend on what in their spy tech. This is a huge kind of get. In fact, one of the Lee Hamilton, an Indiana Democrat who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, said that access to the budget details will enable an informed public debate on intelligence spending for the first time. Much of the work of that the intelligence community does has a profound impact on the life of ordinary Americans, and they ought not to be excluded from the process, is his argument. You know, this is one of the most top secret documents that the government guards. So it's pretty phenomenal that this was able to be leaked. And I think Edward Snowden did this in part because, according to new information from CNET, He accessed these documents by assuming the identities, the electronic identities of top NSA officials, according to intelligence sources. A former U.S. official said, familiar with the case, said, "Every day they're learning how brilliant Snowden was. This is why you don't hire brilliant people for jobs like this. You hire smart people. Brilliant people get you into trouble." As you know,
well, that's a crazy thing, because that just goes to show that we're in a world where corporations and other entities are snapping up workers that feel underemployed. They can't express the true nature of their intelligence or their education. And Edward Snowden, for whatever he is politically, whether he's a traitor or he's a hero or whatever, he did what Americans have oft done in the last 235 years, which is to take advantage of a situation. And he did that. And it's weird to have someone say, "You don't hire brilliant people for these." It's just like a dumb thing to say. It's something I expect some politician to say about some stuff, and not like a real, normal, regular person. You don't hire brilliant people.
Well, it once again gets into that gray area where what he was doing was technically illegal and not part of his job.
But illegality is not something that gets in the way of progress, of moving forward. You don't look at your person and say, "Hey, look, I need to hire these people. Man, this guy's brilliant. It might be illegal if I, you know, he might do something illegal." Like, what the hell is that? In this age of what's it called? Of, you know, like, acqui-hires and all sorts of stuff like that. Like, yes, you hire brilliant people. Why is the government not staffed with the smartest people? Because private industry has figured that, hey, if you're coming out of a great school and you're a really bright person, I want you in my bank. I want you in my tech firm. I want you doing this stuff. I want you to be brilliant. I want you in my consulting agency, like Booz Allen, which Edward Snowden worked for. I want you want the smartest, most brilliant, for, you know, to use this hyperbole, people you can get.
Well, what and he was doing
that's the thing. That's what you want. And if he's going to say businesses don't hire brilliant people, then that confirms that we live in an age of anti-intellectualism, of anti-intellectual curiousness, of anti-intelligence. The George W. Bush focus on, "I want to have a beer with him." He's clearly not focused on the big on the right things, because he's too busy with his nose stuck in a book. He reads too much. He doesn't watch enough movies. All that bullshit that's
well,
I think he was... limit America from being the greatest nation that it can be, because it's focused on like, oh, that person is just too smart.
I think he was focusing more on what he perceived as a devious behavior, because he was essentially Snowden.
If you're a smart man like this, you don't use the term brilliant without knowing what you're saying.
Right.
I'm not going to give him any excuses. Like, there's no excuses here.
Snowden was
you don't attack people with grandiose or tight intelligence and the ability to have vision to move forward. Right, like you don't say like, "Oh, I wouldn't have hired Orson Scott Card."
But I mean, it was illegal what he was doing.
What he was doing, he was not legal. Absolutely,
he was a sysadmin. He had the ability to create and modify user profiles. And what he was doing was
the sysadmin industry by saying, "No, a brilliant sysadmin is not what you want."
What he was doing was that was.
I'm just saying, you don't ever diss intelligence. You don't ever diss innovativeness. You don't ever diss that stuff in the defense of your business.
Absolutely.
You don't say, "I want non-brilliant sysadmins," or imply even that the system administrators who keep our internet running properly are less than brilliant. It was a foolish move.
It was
a stupid move. I'm going to be a talking head and call him an idiot.
He was using other people's user profiles. He was borrowing identities of other people's identities with higher level security clearances to grab those sensitive documents. That's essentially the you know, that's way into the black. That's not even in the gray area.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know what turned Snowden on to what he was doing.
Yeah.
What caused him to want to be this sort of like, let's call it a folk hero. Let's call it whatever.
Right.
But I do know that he was highly motivated to let the American people know about what was going on when it came to this intelligence situation. Now, was it the right thing to do? History will tell. Was it a thing to do that would get him notoriety? Absolutely. We're talking about him now. We need to look at the fact that he's able to pull this off in an age that wasn't just about any brilliance he may have, but an age that was about contractors and a lack of oversight that allowed these kinds of things to happen.
Sure.
We need to make sure that we don't call him, we don't denigrate system administrators who are frankly,
he did call him brilliant.
They're one of the most important aspects of the information age.
Yeah.
Like there was a time when indoor plumbing showed up and you needed plumbers. Now there's a time when the internet is everything and we need people who are going to support and respect and run that internet. And to say that, like, oh, you don't hire people on Edward Snowden's level to do this kind of work because this kind of stuff happens, that shows how stupid you were as a manager, as an industry leader, as whatever the fuck you think you used to be. But the fact is, this man should have gotten let go. This man should have gotten, his shareholders should have been like, get the fuck out. Because Snowden didn't do anything that wasn't allowed by the system that he was around in. He took advantage of it? Absolutely. He did something illegal? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But to diss the intelligence
In other words, it should have been technically it should not have been technically possible for him to do it.
Yeah, brilliant people should have devised a system.
Yes.
And the hiring and the other things, profiling should have happened. Constant check-ins with your people who are working for you should have happened.
Right.
All these things should have happened in a government that spends
all of
our money.
A flaw in the system.
They're taxes are as high as they can be in this country, and they're not spending it on figuring out ways to stop people like Edward Snowden. Instead, they're complaining that he was too smart, and that is nonsense.
What was phenomenal to what was like jaw dropping to me was not so much this as the report from the New York Times, who said that for at least 6 years, law enforcement officials working in with the DEA had routine access using subpoenas to an enormous AT&T database that contains the records of decades of Americans' phone calls. It's parallel, but covering a far longer time than the NSA's leak of a collection of phone call logs. This was a partnership between federal and local drug officials called the Hemisphere Project. That AT&T has kept secret until this report. Hemisphere covers every call that passes through an AT&T switch, not just those made by AT&T customers. It includes calls dating back 26 years, according to Hemisphere training slides held by the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Some 4 billion call records are added to the database every day. That dwarfs the NSA collection of data. That to me was pretty phenomenal. That damning New York Times report on that. What it does is just underscores the level of the lack of privacy we have in our telecommunications. So nothing terribly like incredibly technical about that, other than the fact that. It's just another chink in the privacy and the telecommunication privacy armor. Finally, to wrap up this whole sort of SpyWatch talk, in a blog entry by Microsoft General Counsel Brad Smith, the company explained how negotiations with the government over permission to publish sufficient data relating to FISA orders have faltered, and both Microsoft and Google are proceeding with litigation to seek permission from the FISA court. Essentially, this is Microsoft and Google's way of retaliating over the fact that they were unable to publish data because of the FISA Act silencing them. And I feel like this is Microsoft and Google's way of.
It's a PR move.
Well, but more than that, to me, it feels like that the U.S. government put them in a really sticky situation, particularly with their customers, by them not being able to be open and honest about what they couldn't tell us.
And that's why it's a PR move.
Yeah.
They're like, if I attack the government and say, man, you guys made me tell you this stuff. It's not my fault. You're the government. I can't do it. That makes them look as if they were powerless in the face of a government that was interested in taking information from them. And that's a good thing if you're Google and you want yet more information about everyone using your systems.
Yeah, I think this really call for openness is something that they know is necessary to keep in good standings with all the major institutions and built and major institutions and corporations that use them, not just in the U.S., but around the world, right? Because this has major repercussions and ripples if, you know, Microsoft or Google can't truthfully say, you know, that they are not providing, you know, specific data to the NSA. And that puts them on a negative limelight from the general public, but also from where they make their money, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the big thing here. They need to show the public that they didn't sell them out.
Right.
And whether they did or they didn't.
Right.
As long as they can show, hey, we're attacking the government because of this, the public's going to be like, okay, well, anyone who cares is going to be like, okay, well, at least that's happening, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's worth it. It's worth it for them to sue the government for this.
Exactly.
Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to highlight this week is called Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World by Christopher Steiner. It used to be that to diagnose an illness or interpret legal documents or write a newspaper article, you needed to be a human being with specific skills, maybe an advanced degree or two. These days, those high-level tasks are increasingly being handled by algorithms that can do precise work, not only with speed, but also with nuance. These bots started with human programming and logic, but now their reach extends beyond what their creators ever expected. In this fascinating, frightening audiobook, Christopher Steiner tells the story of how algorithms took over and shows why the bot revolution is about to spill into every aspect of our lives, often silently, without our knowledge. Now, the publisher description calls the audiobook fascinating and frightening, but I don't know if I'm necessarily frightened by it. I mean, I see this in general.
Dude, it's Skynet. It's totally Skynet. And he's letting us know because he's a great guy who's like, die, people, you should know about what's about to happen. And that's a good thing, but it is Skynet. And granted, the publisher has to think about how to sensationalize the shit.
Sure.
But frankly, Skynet. Skynet's happening.
Is that your take on algorithms?
Well, it's my take on the algorithms he's describing, because they're algorithms that supplant the need for human interaction, and that frankly go above and beyond what their creators thought that they would do. Skynet, Cylons. Skynet.
I feel like we've always had to deal with convenience and time-saving innovations like this, and one way to look at it is that it removes the humans having to do those tasks, but in a way, it also allows for other avenues to open up for humans to get into that they
want. Maybe if you live on Elysium, but if you're down here on Earth, Skynet.
All right. Well, we know your take on this. In any case,
wait. What do you think, Skynet?
I'm not going to go that far yet.
Elysium.
I'm not going to reference what I hear was a poor movie either.
Ender's Game. Book
is solid. Book is solid. We should talk more about movies after this break.
I'm just thinking that, like, I think Brave New World. I think, you know, iRobot. Like, hey, the robot's not doing what we thought it was going to do. Oh, shit. We are not okay right now. That's what I think. That's what happens when these things begin to go awry.
I think as long as we build in a fail-safe where we can step in
and
take over.
No one's building in a fail-safe for computers that are doing stuff that you never anticipated them to do.
That's too easy.
What is a fail save? What are fail saves?
All I know is that when I go to
Skynet, pull the plug.
When I go to audible.com, it seems that its algorithms seem to know what I am looking for based on my past experiences. Netflix, too. Netflix is really good at that.
I just wish Netflix gave you a list of all the movies it had instead of being like, oh, this is new. You might like this. Like, just show me everything. Give me an index. Become IMDb. I don't know. I mostly think that what's going to happen with all this stuff is that one day Jeff Bezos is going to wake up and Amazon's going to tell him exactly everything he needs to do for the next, like, 25 years of his life, and it won't let him out of his house. He's going to be like, help, help. And the firemen are going to come, and Amazon's going to be like, I'm named after a river, bitch, and it's going to spray him with water. That's what I'm thinking is going to happen.
To download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's 100,000-plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can quit it and you still get to keep the audiobook for free. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Microsoft buys Nokia, but is it too little too late for Windows Phone? Take a listen to this and come on back.
I'm free to do what I want any old time. I said I'm free to do what I want any old time. I say love.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. And before we talk about Microsoft and Nokia, I just wanted to bring up a little philosophical conundrum here. I saw The World's End recently and loved it. It's the latest movie from director Edgar Wright and stars Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. It's part of his Three Cornetto trilogy, which also includes Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead. Love the movie, and part of the movie, like what really drives the movie is its music, its soundtrack. And so I went to Spotify recently to look for the soundtrack for this movie and found that the Spotify has not licensed yet the soundtrack. So I put together a Spotify playlist and I essentially looked up every song in the soundtrack and I put this playlist together of every song. It's essentially every song that's on the soundtrack. And it's about twice as many songs that are on the official licensed album of the soundtrack. And I thought to myself, there's nothing preventing this Spotify playlist from supplanting the official release of the soundtrack from the studio and it impeding the sale of that release. I mean, it's all legally licensed music and you are a paid subscriber of Spotify. So, in theory, what's stopping anybody from compilations of pre-existing compilation albums? And then I came across this article on Tech Dirt, a record label called Ministry of Sound that puts together compilations of dance music is actually suing Spotify, claiming copyright infringement because someone had put together, one of Spotify's users had put together a playlist and published a playlist in the exact same order as the Ministry of Sound album playlist. And so it brings up a real sort of philosophical conundrum. Is a playlist itself copyright protected if the songs on it...
This is not a philosophical conundrum. It's not. It's a matter of law. Law doesn't care about that kind of thing. And the fact is, the very idea of a playlist itself has been patented. And because it's been patented, its contents can be copyrighted. So, it's a done deal.
No, not necessarily. Like
Apple paid $8 million to the guy who patented the playlist.
No, we're not talking about the playlist as a concept itself. We're talking about the specific order of songs.
Yes, the fact that the contents of any playlist can now be copyrighted.
Not necessarily. That's the gray area that we're talking about. Like, I think...
I don't know how gray it is. I think that some reporter wants to think it's gray. It's not gray. You can do it.
No, I don't... that's where I think you're wrong. That's where I think that's what the situation... Like, the Ministry of Sound's argument is that... curation is the cornerstone of their business for the last 20 years, and if somebody doesn't step up and take action against the service and users are dismissing their curation skills as just a list, it opens up the floodgates to anyone who wants to copy what a curator is doing. But the argument is that
radio has been complaining about for years.
What? Who has been?
Radio. Like, that's what radio complains about. The program directors are like, hey, look, that's my situation. That's my list.
Question is, why should Spotify be liable for how its users group their songs together?
The same reason why the Pirate Bay is liable for how their users use their services. As a platform, you put yourself at risk for your users' behavior.
But I think philosophically, like, Pirate Bay is responsible if they actually had content on their systems. They don't. They have magnet links that link to the content on other people's drives.
I mean, tell that to Mini Nova. Tell that to the Pirate Bay guys who've changed their URL like 4 times in the last 6 years.
So I think that's
like,
I
just don't think you can call it gray. It's not gray. You can say that you can disagree with it, and I think that you do disagree with it. But it's not gray. In terms of the way it's dealt with by the authorities, it's not gray.
Well, I think it's difficult because I think it really depends who you're looking at in terms of the authority figure, right? So, like, if we're looking at it from someone like the movie industry, they consider it, you know, the fault. They consider the onus being... Well, I mean, then what does the law say about, like, Google having links to particular things, right? The law
Google went and said, hey, look, we're going to do our best to limit the exposure of search results of copyrighted materials. Because we, as Google, do not want to have to deal with that legal question.
But I think that's they've also said. Gone out and said that it's not under our control. I mean, I'm giving Google just an example, but I think lots of other organizations online have said it's
many
not
of them do it. Basically, Nutella said that, Direct Connect said that, the Pirate Bay said that, the BitTorrent company has said that, the guys who make the BitTorrent protocol. And categorically, over time, because of the amount of money spent, they've all lost. BitTorrent exists because it exists, but the guys like at the MPAA have been able to show that the Pirate Bay is a problem, that Mini Nova is a problem.
Sure, but we're talking about
you're looking at let's go to Spotify. I'm using examples of copyrighted materials.
Can you copyright a curated list? Is the question.
Yes, because it's a specific list. You can copyright anything that's specific. Absolutely, you can copyright it. And then if Spotify takes it and publishes it and is paying
but
out...
But they're not publishing it.
Spotify is the platform under which it's published. So yes, Spotify can be called responsible for it. Now, should Spotify fight it? Perhaps they should. But the reason this is news is because it's like, oh my God, this is happening. Of course it's happening. Someone sat there and curated a list, and that list is a plagiarizable thing, right? It's like anything else you write down, and you can call rights to it. Even if you don't call rights, even if as a list owner, you don't call rights to the specific copyrighted works on top of it, you're saying, I copyrighted this particular list, and if you're going to play it, then I want my dollars. Because that's the problem, and I'm going to use the word problem with a capital P, I'm going to use it in all caps, italicized, underlined, and bolded. That's the problem with the way we deal with ideas in this country. So I'm not saying that I'm sitting here and being like, oh, of course, you know, like that's the way it's got to be. All I'm saying is that that's the way it is. And we shouldn't be surprised when that happens.
The well, you know, this lawsuit is being filed in Great Britain, and there have been other similar lawsuits. There have been similar lawsuits regarding curated lists, and those have all been overturned on appeal.
On appeal, that shows that the actual law does not necessarily
it's in dispute,
quickly
but
and
not
easily
exactly.
represent. Yeah, like
so, I feel like we really are here in a gray area here.
Well, I feel like we're in an area that shows that if it's all getting turned over on appeal, that shows that lower courts, when reading the law, almost unilaterally see it as a problem, and higher courts are looking at it from a more social perspective. The law is not a completely fluid thing like they try to tell you in school.
Yeah.
The law is an attempt at the practical application of society. The higher courts have the authority to interpret the law in ways that help that benefit society by what we can call our better angels. But when the lower court looks at the law, it looks at the law as it's written and not as it's meant to be necessarily. And because of that, we can see clearly that you can copyright a list. The question we have to ask is that right? And what do we have what kind of arms do we have to take up against that problem?
Is it a useful purpose for a copyright?
Exactly. It's like the whole patent situation. How useful is that, right? Yeah. Like, the laws are clear. That's what laws are.
Yeah, but I think that in this case, the laws are definitely unclear since there is a dispute. However, just for the sake of elucidation, I'm going to post my Spotify The World's End playlist in the show notes. And you can check it out for yourself and determine for yourself whether or not it's better or worse than the official studio release. All right, moving on here to... So Microsoft announced earlier this week that it's buying the majority of Nokia's cell phone unit for $5 billion. And another $2.18 billion to license Nokia's patent portfolio. License Nokia's patent portfolio.
Nokia did not sell the band portfolio. They
that
said,
is correct.
Hey,
yes. So it's a clear sign that Microsoft believes it can and must succeed in the phone business and cannot afford to leave the success in the hands of a partner, even one like Nokia. Now, we talked about this episodes ago.
We talked about it like literally in 2011 when Nokia and Microsoft made this exclusive agreement where Nokia said, we are not going to build Android phones. We're going to build Microsoft phones. And the talk that we had was in late 2011 saying, should Microsoft just pony up the money and buy Nokia? And why? Because they bought Skype, because they bought McAfee, because they bought all these random things that are not as powerful as Nokia was in 2011.
Yeah. And it turns out that that's exactly what ended up happening. It's interesting, though, that Nokia Microsoft is decided to license Nokia's patents rather than buying them outright.
I think that was a Nokia decision, not a Microsoft decision.
Yeah. But Nokia. I think Nokia feels like it's because they've licensed the patents to Microsoft rather than letting them purchase it that they can. They can still go after. Like other manufacturers for royalties after using their patents rather than, you know, they haven't given up that. This is like the patents are, they still consider patents to be the crown jewels.
Well, if you're Nokia, you know, Nokia is behind the GSM standard that the world uses except for the CDMA networks in America and Korea. Nokia is behind a lot of the growth in the developing world when it comes to wireless usage.
Yeah.
Nokia has technology that other people are like, oh, I want some of that. I have to license it from Nokia. So by keeping, if you're Nokia, you're like the Finnish super company. They were like 4% of Finnish GDP throughout much of their late history. You're going to want to keep a thing that allows money to continue to come in
Yeah.
So you're able to maintain a certain level of your independence. It's like with Motorola Mobility, it's a name, but we can all see that name going away in the name of Google phones. Nokia is trying to keep that from happening. They want to remain independent. They want Stephen Elop to protect them, even though they were upset with him for telling the truth about what they were and how they had failed with the you know, Miko operating system. So what's interesting to me is that Stephen Elop left Microsoft because of the opportunity at Nokia. Now Nokia is virtually bought by Microsoft.
Yes.
And frankly, he is in the running to become the next CEO after Steve Ballmer, as the vision of the company is focused on creating embedded devices, hardware devices like the Surface and the Windows Phone and the Xbox that need great software from Microsoft and great hardware from Microsoft. They're moving to the Apple model. They're moving to the Google Nexus model. And Stephen Elop has been able to say, hey, I've been running shit and you want me, you know? Now, granted, Nokia needs to be bought by somebody.
Right.
But Elop is in a very good position to be the next CEO of Microsoft.
Well, let me ask you a question. Where do you see this leads the future of Windows Phone?
The future of Windows Phone is Microsoft being in charge of building these devices using the Nokia brand to push them across overseas.
Yeah.
And to basically, Windows Phone isn't going to chase down the iPhone. It's going to chase down the bad Android experiences. And and that's why Google is attacking its YouTube application and other things. Windows Phone is going to chase down these bad gingerbread 3 years later Android experiences and show a better way. Because Windows Phone is not a bad operating system. It's a late operating system.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I think, I don't know, Tosin's in the Valley. He's played with Windows Phone. What do you think, Tosin?
Windows Phone is actually an interesting beast. So I was at Microsoft's Build conference, so I was using a lot of the Windows devices, and touchscreen is fairly nice. I think it's going to be an interesting meld between Nokia as well as the Windows Phone. I think Windows Phone will live on for a bit. To tell you the truth, I actually feel like this is more of a purchase, not necessarily for Nokia or Microsoft, because both their market shares are fairly small in that industry, but more so, as people have been stating, as potential new CEO. I really feel strongly about that, because I think that is the most compelling storyline in terms of this deal being done. Especially for the price that it was placed at.
This is like an acqui-hire for Stephen Elop.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely believe that.
Well, he's a sure thing. He's a sure thing as an MS executive, right? And he's been hanging out, and like Nokia has done better ever since he basically said to the world, we screwed up.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a 41 or 43 pixel telephone.
Right.
Boom.
Right.
Like, okay.
A bit overkill.
Well, is it overkill, or are people going to try to catch up now that they've gotten this attention and now they'll have the full weight of Microsoft behind them? I just feel as if, especially with Office 365 showing up on mobile devices, there's a chance to push Windows Phone. They've got to push hard. They've got to spend the money on development and on advertising. And frankly, they're going to have to take over fucking Europe and be like, this is a Nokia phone. Your money's going to a nice Nokia, a nice European company, and we're going to support the Opera browser and all that stuff. But, I mean, Elop is right now, he's the golden man. He's been on that part of the tech world, is what I mean to say, that Microsoft desperately wants to be a part of. This embedded mobile device thing. And with the backing of Microsoft's coffers, they can do something there, especially if they focus on tying it to the Xbox in a way that's even more meaningful than it is today.
Tying it to the Xbox, that's interesting.
Well, the Xbox is one of the big growth markets of Microsoft. It's hardware that Microsoft exclusively produces. They have a network of developers that is focused on the Xbox. If they can migrate those developers directly to the Windows Phone situation, directly to this other straight-up hardware that ELOP is behind, they can really get some traction and begin to move forward. Huh. And maybe they won't be your office situation, but they will be your entertainment situation. And that's powerful.
Hmm. This essentially makes Nokia the supply-side distributor for Windows Phone almost exclusively.
And let's not forget, Nokia is an ancient company. They're about 138 years old.
Sure, sure.
Nokia sold paper.
Right.
They were a paper mill. And they got into this phone business in a pretty exciting way. So They in the 90s, they moved into the phone business. But the fact is, Nokia has been around for a very long time. They pivoted, and that pivot is what we're seeing happen with Microsoft itself. It has to pivot if it wants to make sure that it's to grow.
I like your Tosin, you pasted a link to an infographic sort of illustrating the significance or insignificance, as it were, of where Windows Phone and Nokia stand in the grand scheme of OSs.
Yeah, it's very, very small and fraction of the overall current market.
Sure. Windows Phone is 2% of the market compared to 40% for iOS and 52% for Android. And Nokia, proportionately speaking, is 1.2% of the market compared to Apple and Samsung at 40% and 24%. So, interesting. Well, we'll see. That's why I think, I don't know, that this, it may be too little too late for Windows Phone at this point. I mean, they have a guaranteed distributor now with Nokia, but who's really buying? Maybe the third world.
I don't know what the third world is, because today we use the term developing world. But I do think that they're going to have to appeal to the U.S., and they're going to have to appeal to emerging markets like Russia, India, China,
emerging markets,
and Brazil. I think they're going to have to appeal to those guys, because that's where the growth is, and those guys are used to the Microsoft name. And I think they're really going to have to appeal to Europe. Europe is going to have to look at their economic interests and their economic plan and say, Nokia means money is coming in to our union, and we need to focus on making sure that happens in the tech sector. I mean, they were boxed out of the browser wars by Microsoft, and they can't be boxed out of the mobile wars. They simply can't be.
We're going to take one last break, and when we come back, PAX Prime from Tosin's point of view. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Now, Tosin, last week you were at PAX Prime. You were reporting to us from PAX Prime, but I think you had yet, like, PAX was just starting when we were recording the show, so you had not had the PAX Prime experience yet. And this week you've done it. First of all, explain to listeners who may not be familiar with what PAX is. What is PAX?
So PAX stands for Penny Arcade Expo. It's run by the guys who run Penny Arcade. So they're both run that comic. That would be Jerry and Mike. They're alter egos, Gabe and Tycho from Penny Arcade. And it's really the way I see it is it's a gaming convention made by gamers for gamers. Ah. So unlike a lot of the other conventions you get out there, which are really directed more towards media or directed towards the stars out there, this is really just for overall enjoyment of games and a way to facilitate that. Media don't really get any special privileges from the convention and you know are just like normal attendees for the most part. And the thing about PAX that is also really enjoyable and unique about it is it's not just video games, not just computer games, but it's a love of games. So there are sections dedicated to board games or storytelling or D&D, etc. So it's a pretty cool community to check out. And this is actually the first time that PAX has been 4 days. So typically it was a Friday, Saturday, Sunday convention, and now it is a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday convention. So a lot to see, a lot to do, and ever growing.
And what were some of the highlights of this year's PAX Prime that you that really sort of stood out for you?
So, in terms of highlights, the way I see PAX is it's really what you make of the experience. Uh-huh. So, I've had some PAXes where I was purely interested in the panels, and others where I did, you know, other sorts of games. But I think one of the always unique things about PAX is the indie games that you get to see or the less known games.
Sure.
Ones that you may not get to experience later on unless you do a little bit of digging around. And I'll touch upon a few of the ones that I noticed. So one of the things which I attended a lot of this time because my friend was in it is this event called the Omegathon, and really what it is, they random attendees are selected from PAX beforehand, and they battle out in a competition of games to a final round, which is a hidden game, and the winner gets to go to a Tokyo Game Show, all expense paid trip,
wow.
And the loser gets to compete in the Omegathon the next year, so gets an all expense paid trip to compete again. So it's a pretty epic thing. And one of the games which I saw in, I think it was the second to last round, was this game called Battle Block Theater. And what it was is it's a set of mini games that you can play with four people. Uh-huh. And one of the game modes they had was a King of the Hill type game, which is just really compelling, very colorful, unique in the type of skills that you had. It's in the sort of same... It's a game developed by the Behemoth, so you may recognize them from Castle Crashers and other type games, so somewhat a similar art style. And it was just a lot of fun Xbox Live arcade game, which I definitely recommend. Now, in terms of other indie games, indie titles that I saw, there's one called Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time, which is a two-player co-op game where you're basically co-runners of a spaceship. You move around your characters within this sort of circular ship, and you can move around and work different elements of the ship, and your real goal is to micromanage the ship but also free inhabitants of planets and rescue them as well as destroy aliens. And it's just really cool in terms of, you know, one person can be in the part steering the ship while another person can go around and work the different weapon systems or shields, and it's just actually it's a ton of fun, really great to play. And a final game that you may not have heard much about is a game called Tingami. It's this iPad game, and it's actually really beautiful. It's made in sort of a pop-up book style, so when you flip through the various pages, the world kind of pops up and changes and adapts. It's just really clever looking, and I think it's going to be quite a game to see. So those are some of the indie titles that I noticed. Another Zelda one kind of called Owlboy, where you can actually fly. Now, in terms of really heavy-hitting things that I'm sure a lot of people will have heard of, there are, I think, three things I want to talk about.
Sure.
One is Super Mario 3D. And I know there have been other co-op Mario games out there, but this is a four-player co-op game, and it was a blast to play. It made me actually consider getting a Wii U, you know, if there are other similar titles, because I was just basically running through the worlds with different skills and power-ups in a 3D environment and just having a blast with several people who I'd never played the game with. So it was great, a lot of fun. The second thing is this game called Contrast. I may have spoken about this, or we may have touched about it before, but it's basically a puzzle platformer where you're playing as an imaginary friend, and you can shift from a 2D plane become a shadow into the 3D world. And of course, through the course of the game, you can manipulate the shadows and light forces. And this game is coming out for, you know, both PlayStations as well as Steam and Xbox, and it is, from what I can see, it definitely has that noir feel.
Sure.
It definitely has this great elegance behind it, and I think it's going to be a deal breaker. And the final thing is, the final thing, which I'm sure we've mentioned a lot, is Oculus Rift. Oculus Rift was there, but so was Oculus Rift in combination with Omni. And I didn't actually get to try it, but watching it was actually really cool, because the Omni not only does it allow you to run, and you can see the translation between the person performing the action, as well as it lets you jump. So other sorts of motions that I didn't really think that were going to be achievable. The only negative that I've heard about it is that for some people it's just so realistic that, you know, they just feel sick. They truly feel like they're in an environment, maybe even trapped in a room, and have to, you know, quickly remove the helmet. So
Omni is the stationary treadmill, gaming treadmill.
Yes, exactly. That's the one where you wear special shoes that keep you within it, and you're kind of locked into
guys,
the whole treadmill.
Ready Player One. Tosin, if you haven't read it yet, Ready Player One. You're talking about the Oasis.
Essentially, I mean, Oasis, you put on this haptic stillsuit. You're that's essentially correct.
Yeah, no.
If you're listening to this and you haven't gotten your hands on Ready Player One or downloaded the Audible book, Ready Player One. I mean, that's where we're going if we don't watch out. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. It's an awesome dystopia to be in, of all the dystopias science fiction has given us.
Yeah, it was overall, PAX was a blast. So many other things I could talk to you about, so many other crazy things. Like I mentioned before, my panel, which went amazing, and we'll have video of that up pretty soon to
Very
share
cool.
with everyone. But if you've never been before and you're a fan of games, fan of technology, looking to meet cool and unique people and connect with like-minded individuals, I definitely recommend checking it if you get a chance. And they have one in Seattle. They have one in Boston around, you know, spring break, around March, as well as now there's one in Australia. So if you get a chance.
I don't suppose that there will ever be one in Los Angeles, because it directly competes with E3, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think they're probably trying to spread one out. There was talk of potentially a fourth one. Very, very... I'm not sure how likely that is, given how much time it takes.
Boulder!
It's always funny. Everyone's like, PAX my house.
Right.
It's literally where it is. But we'll see what happens. Maybe it'll be London even. Who knows?
I would definitely go if it was
London. Enough. London makes sense, because London is in Europe. It's between Australia and the U.S., and it has all the who heads, the Whovians.
All right. And before we sign off for the night, our drill down video of the week, and this comes courtesy of you, Dwayne. And first of all, what the heck is this?
It's I don't even know how to explain it. It's a fantastic animation that just shows the power of traditional animation today and how other cultures can represent conflict, not armed conflict, but just like character conflict in fantastic ways that just blow your mind. It to me is the same. It gave me the same feeling I got when I watched my first anime. Like, it's like, I don't look at things this way, and this is awesome. So check it out.
This is courtesy of Fox's Animation Domination High Def program, ADHD, appropriately named. And it's called Story from South America. And it's, I don't even know how to describe it. Just, you've just got to
watch it. As a South American, I'm going to tell you, just watch it.
Yeah, just watch it. I can't promise that it'll make any more sense after you watched it, but it'll...
You'll be happy, yes, that's for sure.
It'll be a unique experience, something that you have never seen anything like before, so, for sure. So thanks, Dwayne, for turning us on to that. All right, let's go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find you when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. And you can see most of what I do at flavors.me/DwayneD. And then you can find me here on the Drill Down week after week, doing what Andy tells me to do.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work on the internet?
Now you can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can find my other ramblings as well as information on this PAX prank coming soon on ircwebcast.blogspot.com. In a few days, you'll get to hear about that. And, of course, you can find me here on The Drill Down.
Can we are we going to be able to link the video for your panel this week, or do we need to wait for next week?
Sadly, it's going to have to be next week.
Okay.
We've got 8 gigs of data that we're uploading in the box right now, and we'll have to cut that together. So
very cool. All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Facebook.com, and Twitter.com at MrBabyMan. Also, you can just Google MrBabyMan, and I'm there. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next time. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us. So, Dwayne, you saw The Grandmaster? This is the story. This is like the biography of the famous martial arts master Ip Man who trained Bruce Lee. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a couple movies. You can actually hop on Netflix right now and find Ip Man and Ip Man 2, right? Yeah. IP space MAN. That's this guy's name. He was around, as a young guy in the 20s and 30s. And in the 50s, he was older, and he moved to Hong Kong after the Second Great War, and that's where he ran into Bruce Lee. There were so many styles of Kung Fu. And in this film, unlike the films that you can find on Netflix that were created before, Ip Man, it's about his origin. It's about, not even his origin, it's about how he already had the respect of his people. Of the Kung Fu community, how these battles that they had were symbolic, and also how he took what he had and he was able to transform it into what Kung Fu is now, and basically like the tragedy that befall that came across China during the Japanese era. What's really interesting to me is that I've seen all the Ip Man movies. I'm a fan, and this film by Wong Kar-wai, who is by far my favorite director. I won't get into all the reasons why, but sure. He skipped over the subject material covered by other movies.
Smart.
In order to create a piece that was about this Ip Man's character, its the realities of it and its flaws. and to make a kung fu movie that was also an art house movie.
Hmm.
When you watch the battles in this thing,
uh-huh.
you're getting that art house Cannes Film Festival stuff that you get in the movies that are titled In the Mood for Love or Happy People or 2046 that Wong Kar-wai has made. Wong Kar-wai focuses on characterization. He'll spend forever getting these actors to just stand around and be the characters. He'll film it, and then he'll put together a story that is astounding.
Right. His milieu is typically these dramatic characterizations, these deep, moving stories about characters.
Characters that exist in a world that is simply unfair. From like a...
Sure.
Where love exists... Yep. Love exists like you see it in some National Geographic film about antelopes and like jaguars, right? Like that jaguar, that antelope is cute, but it has to die so the leopard can live. And that's kind of how these movies are shot. There's this weird objectivism to them that makes you as a human just feel more. Zhang Ziyi of Couching Tiger, Hidden Dragon fame, or like Memoirs of a Geisha fame, is in this movie. And for the first time, her character, the characterization she has, she's been in another Wong Kar-wai movie, 2046, but for the first time, her characterization is astounding. She acts in a way that I've not seen her act in film before. Like, I'm like, wow, this is an actress that is truly an actress.
Yeah.
It's not just about her fighting, her ability to dance, fight her way out of something, or, you know, she's 32, 34 years old now. She can't be the petulant child anymore in movies. So she's forced to act. And when she acts, you're moved. And obviously Wong Kar-wai cares very much about telling his audience these things about these characters. And I gotta say, I was goosebumped. I was moved. I hate most movies. Wong Kar-wai was able to impress me yet again. So this is why he's one of my favorite directors. Not because he's, you know, he can do no wrong, but because he manages to make me not be able to understand what's gonna happen next, and to surprise and delight me with the way he deals with his characters. I mean, it's good work. It's very good work. It's an action movie.
Sure,
all this art house talk, and it doesn't go more than 10 minutes without another scene of action.
Awesome. That sounds like a combination that I've rarely, if ever, seen in any movie. Because often you'll see dramatic movies attempted by directors who have more of an action sort of background. And fail miserably, but rarely ever do you see an action movie attempted by such a hardcore dramatic director as Wong Kar-wai.
Yeah, I mean, it really is something to see. If you haven't spent any time looking at Wong Kar-wai movies, get on Amazon, see if you can pick up one or two of his films, because he does things in a different way. He's been known to spend as much as 4 years filming a movie, which is nuts. Mm-hmm. From a modern perspective, 4 years to get, like, the actors age from frame to frame in the film because it takes that long to figure out what he's got to do. But the end result is worth it. And in this film especially, there's love, there's honor betrayed, there's love betrayed. They're the kind of vows that you only find in Chinese movies where you're like, why would you ever make that vow? And then someone does. And just like Crouching Tiger, just like 2046, just like so many movies, there is that Romeo and Juliet super inability to consummate, and that makes you just itch as an American.
Yeah.
Fantastic film.
I'll definitely have to check that out, because I really know nothing about the Ip Man. I didn't see the two Ip Man titled movies. So
they're worth seeing because they won't get in the way of what you're going to see by Wong Kar-wai. He just takes it to that next level, you know. And you know, between and this Zhang Ziyi actress, I mean, she's done strange things in her life and so on. But between the Ang Lee movie, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon,
sure,
which was kind of amazing but silly, and 2046, which was just amazing, and this movie, which is even more amazing. 2046 was amazing but kind of strange. It was a strange paradigm. The future and the 60s and the future and the 60s. This movie, you get stuck on her because she's a key part of showing this amazing man's character and how he got where he got and how Kung Fu got where it got. She's a part of Kung Fu history, her characterization in this film.
Right.
And it's strange, you know, like it hasn't been since the 70s that women have had this much power in these kinds of movies in China. So it's worth seeing.
Cool. I'll check it out. All right. Good night, guys.
Later. Bye.